Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to our half-hour English feature program. I'm Susie Hodges. These are the stories coming up today. Papal Appeal. Pope Benedict urges the G8 leaders to take decisions that promote true development, especially for the world's poor, and also reflects on his newest encyclical, Charity in Truth, that looks at economic issues. Encyclical Insight. One of the economists that helped advise Pope Benedict during the writing of his latest encyclical tells us more about this groundbreaking document. Broken Promises. As the G8 leaders at their summit near Aquila in Italy wrap up the first day of their talks, we find out why Caritas Internationalis believes there is little chance of increased tangible aid for the world's poor coming out of this meeting. Here in the Vatican, Pope Benedict said he prayed that G8 leaders meeting in L'Aquila, Italy, may take decisions promoting true development, especially for the world's poor. He also reflected on his just-released encyclical, Caritas in Veritate, that looks at the global economy and presents the indispensable principles for true human development. The Pope was speaking at his Wednesday general audience that coincided with the start of the G8 summit and came one day after the release of his first encyclical dealing with social issues. Chris Altieri tells us more.
The Holy Father's prayer came in the context of his reflections on his encyclical letter Caritas in Veritate, which was released on Tuesday. In English-language remarks to the faithful, the Pope said some 40 years after Pope Paul VI's encyclical Populorum Progressio, Caritas in Veritate too addresses social themes vital to the well-being of humanity and reminds us that authentic renewal of both individuals and society requires living by Christ's truth in love, which stands at the heart of the Church's social teaching.
The encyclical does not aim to provide technical solutions to these social problems, but instead focuses on the principles indispensable for human development. Most important among this is human life itself, the center of all true progress. Additionally, it speaks of the right to religious freedom as a part of human development. It warns against unbounded hope in technology alone, and it underlines the need for upright men and women attentive to the common good in both politics and the business world.
The Holy Father went on to say that in regard to matters of particular urgency affecting the world today, the encyclical addresses a wide range of issues and calls for decisive action to promote food security and agricultural development, as well as respect for the environment and for the rule of law.
Stressed is the need for politicians, economists, producers, and consumers alike to ensure that ethics shape economics so that profit alone does not regulate the world of business. Dear friends, humanity is a single family where every development program, if it is to be integral, must consider the spiritual growth of human persons and the driving force of charity in truth. Let us pray for all souls who serve in politics and the management of economies, and in particular let us pray for the heads of state gathering in Italy for the G8 summit. May their decisions promote true development, especially for the world's poor.
Following the audience, Pope Benedict privately received the consorts of the G8 leaders, after which they strolled through the Vatican Gardens and the Lourdes Grotto. I'm Chris Altieri.
In his newest encyclical, Pope Benedict calls for a new world financial order guided by ethics, human dignity, and the search for the common good. The document outlines the goals and values that the faithful must defend to ensure solidarity among all peoples and true human development. The Pope said the current global economic crisis was clear proof of the pernicious effects of sin in the economy and urged financiers to rediscover ethics in their dealings. He also urged wealthier countries to increase development aid to poor countries to help eliminate world hunger, saying that peace and security depended on it. Stefano Zamagni, professor of political economy at Italy's Bologna University, was one of the Pope's principal economic advisers during the writing of the encyclical. He shared his insights about the document with my colleague Veronica Scarisbrook. We had the first part of that interview on yesterday's programme, and now let's hear the second and final part.
In the fourth chapter, Pope Benedict, among other things, points out how while in opulent societies people claim the right to the superfluous, in other areas of the world people lack basic necessities such as water and food. Does the Pope make any suggestions in terms of attempting to find ways of including the excluded?
Yes. Again, the proper word in this regard is solidarity. We know that there are two types of solidarity, what are called productive solidarity and redistributive solidarity. Now, so far, when the attention was given to the poor in generic terms, the temptation has always been to try to cope the problems of the poor with redistributive policies. In other words, I am richer than you, I put my hand in my pocket and I try to give you some of my money. That is okay, but that is, technically speaking, that is called philanthropy. Now, the true solidarity is different. Is when I try to help you to become free from your need. Now, this concept of solidarity, which I call productive solidarity, it's an old one. It appeared for the first time in 1137, in a famous document called Carta Caritatis. Carta means charter, like, yeah, Caritatis. And that was the result of San Bernard Chiaravalle, of the sister senses. They were the first school of economic thought. The fact is that most economists do not know these things. That is why they keep on saying things which are obsolete. Now, in Carta Caritatis, the basic idea is the best way to help the poor is to teach them to work, to modify the rules of the economic game in such a way that they can be internalized into the market. Now, this idea was taken later, two centuries later, by the Franciscans, by a famous dictum which circulated in the culture of the time, which says, alms help to survive, but not to live, since to live is to produce, and alms giving do not help producing. Mm. That is a fascinating dictum which already circulated in the 14th century, but which we have forgotten because we keep on pretending to cope with the problems of the poor in assistentialistic, paternalistic way. That is, no, even particularly in these days when major African economists, they say to us, Western people, stop giving aid, because they get aid in financial terms which goes to Africa, goes in the pockets of the leaders. Most of them are corrupted and not to the real needy.
So the Pope suggests a long-term vision.
Yes.
The next chapter sees Pope Benedict insisting as to how Christianity can only contribute to development if God finds a place in the public arena. Isn't this idea rather far-fetched? Not everybody believes in God, and it might not apply to many of the movers and shakers of the world economy.
No, it certainly could be like that. The point is that, as we know, the Christian conception of God is different from the conception of other religions. And perhaps the best way to understand that is to remind ourselves what the fathers of the Church, 4th, 15th and 6th century, so a long time ago, used to call incarnation. Incarnation is one of the most important mystery of the Christian faith. They called incarnation sacrum commercium, which means sacred trade. Unbelievable, already in those days, because according to the Christian vision of God, God is not somebody, is somebody who has created the world but has not finished it. So human beings have to finish the work started by God. That is why incarnation, that is the message of incarnation. We are not supposed simply to pray, but we have to act, to produce operations, to produce operas in one direction or the other.
Finally, the Holy Father warns against the danger of globalization replacing ideology with technology. Is he getting at anything in particular there?
Yes, there is this new ideology which says everything which is possible should and could be done. That is an ideology because puts the principle of efficiency as if it were the only principle of our society. That is true because efficiency is a very important principle, but it belongs to the order of means, not to the order of ends. Everybody should be efficient, but what for? It's a moral and political decision. You cannot say, I do that, I perform that way because I want to be efficient. That is nonsense, or at best is a tautological. You have to say, my target is so and so, and because of that, I want to be efficient. That is the new technological ideology, which confuses efficiency, which is a mean to make it an end.
So in a nutshell, this long-awaited encyclical calls for a radical rethinking of economics so that it's not guided not simply by profits, but by an ethics which is people-centered, right?
Yes. Again, there is an important passage in the encyclical when the Pope says it is obvious that economics should be married with ethics.
That was Stefano Zamagni talking to Veronica Scarisbury. The leaders of the G8 countries are currently holding their annual summit meeting, which this year is being hosted by Italy, just outside the earthquake-hit city of L'Aquila. But what is likely to emerge from this two-day meeting being attended by leaders of the world's leading eight industrialized nations? The G8 summit is taking place against the backdrop of the current global financial crisis, and was preceded, as we just heard, by appeals from the Pope and many other church figures for the G8 leaders to fulfil their commitments to help the poor on our planet. But are the G8 leaders likely to heed those appeals? And more importantly, will they keep their promises on aid for the world's poorest and most vulnerable people? Looking at the outcome of past G8 summits, the omens are not good, according to Patrick Nicholson, head of communications at Caritas Internationalis, who sees this year's summit as a make-or-break meeting where the G8 must prove its relevance.
Well, G8 leaders in the past have been pretty poor in delivering on the promises that they've made. And we can look at two countries in particular, Italy and France, which have really backtracked on their commitments. Italy has only paid 3% of the money it's promised in aid. And if you look at both Italy and France together, their backlog in money and support for developing countries is 80% of the total that the G8 owes. So some countries have done well, the UK, Japan, Canada, but others have we really seen an absolute reneging of promises. And from the G8s that I've been covering since Birmingham over 10 years ago now, Gleneagles was good, but you see promises that are broken time and time again.
OK, you mentioned there Italy and its poor record, and it is, of course, the host country at the ongoing G8 summit, and it's seeking to promote a new whole-of-country approach to assessing the amount of development aid. What's your views on this?
Well, it could work, but it It depends what's thrown in there and what's left out of there. I mean, an approach which looks at the whole of the country is a very good idea, but it also has to take into consideration the money that developing countries steal or take from poor countries through the amount they subsidise agriculture, the amount that trade restrictions bar poor countries from getting full access to the global economy. So if it really is a whole country approach, and if it really does introduce independent audits of G8 countries, then that could be a good thing. But our worries are in the detail. All that will be left out, and all that you'll see are what rich countries want to show and what they want to hide. So, for example...
So they could be massaging the figures?
There certainly could be a massaging of figures. I mean, we'd hate to see the Italian government say, for example, that they should consider what the Vatican gives or what the Catholic Church does and what Caritas does on aid in their figures, because they give us no money. It doesn't come out of Italian taxpayers' pockets. So that kind of massaging of figures would really be reprehensible. And again, you know, the people who suffer are the poorest people in the world, and playing financial tricks is going to be evident and is going to be visible to anybody who travels to poor countries, because you'll see it in the hungry people who don't have access to food, clean water or education.
Now, one of the top items that the G8 leaders are discussing at this summit is climate change. And again, this is something that's going to hit and is already hitting poor people in developing countries hardest. What action is likely to come out, in your view?
Well, there are big climate change talks at the end of the year in Copenhagen. And what would be great is if the G8 leaders committed to being at those climate change talks, so the leaders themselves being present in Copenhagen. And once they're there, that they live up to really doing something about climate change. That means reducing the greenhouse gas emissions that rich countries are producing that are causing climate change, which will impact on the poor the worst, and for poor countries to receive the kind of aid that they need to adapt to that climate change. So we really want to see a strong commitment for G8 leaders to be at Copenhagen, and for also for those negotiations to move forward. Already we're seeing a kind of backtracking from rich negotiating countries saying we'll only sign up to a vague promises at Copenhagen, but we just don't have the time to waste on vague promises. We really need to see firm commitments. Since the Rio climate meeting, which is now over a decade ago, we're seeing the same thing again and again, vague commitments but no detail. And really what we need to see, or what politicians have to sell, is that our standard of life in the developed world is no longer justifiable or tenable. We really need to lower our standard of living, or to lower our consumption of goods. And that's going to be a very difficult nettle to grasp, but it's one that politicians have to sell, and they have to sell to their people. It's going to be very unpopular, but until they start with that message, we won't see any movement on climate change.
And do you think also some of this backtracking and reluctance to grasp this nettle is also due to the ongoing global economic crisis? You know, money's tighter all round, so this has been seen as a way to sort of, as you say, backtrack?
Well, it hasn't stopped people spending, rich government spending money on arms, has it? So the argument would be, if you can spend money on arms, the US spent more money on arms in 2008 than it ever has done. So if you can spend more money on arms, then you can certainly spend it on relieving poverty and doing something to tackle climate change. Climate change is something the whole world bears responsibility for and will be affected by, and we really cannot afford to waste any more time.
Looking at the more general issue of poverty, I mean, we've seen as a result of the global economic crisis that an extra 100 million people have slid back into poverty. Do you think there's any chance of reaching these goals? We seem to be going backwards rather than forwards.
Well, on some of the goals, there has been success. I mean, we've seen things turn around in Asia over the last 20 years or so, although they have been suffering as a result of the global economic crisis. But when you go to to poor countries or countries with very poor infrastructure. And when you see how aid can really make a difference, for example, in the debt crisis, children were put into education in Kenya, in Ghana, in Tanzania, whereas before they didn't receive education. So there are tangible examples of where aid really does work. We know it works, and therefore we know that failure to reach those goals because of lack of financing is completely morally unacceptable. Developed countries do have the funds available, and therefore we need to marry the two, make sure those funds go into projects which are effective. And that also means giving poor communities and the civil society that represents them a say in how aid is spent. It's not just about aid quantity, it's also about quality of aid spending, and we need to see improvements in how taxpayers' money from rich country more effectively improves the lives of poor people. And that certainly is possible. I've seen it for myself in Ethiopia, where you see one mountain which has received money to help its water retention so that people can grow crops and it's green and verdant and people are much better fed and educated and they can afford medicine and schooling. And then you go to the next village which hasn't received aid, or the next mountain which hasn't received aid, and it's like a desert. So there are stark examples of where aid does work.
How has Caritas been actively campaigning in the run-up to this summit in terms of lobbying government leaders, lobbying opinion makers, the media?
Well, I mean, all of our members have run campaigns for many years on the G8. For us, the problem with the G8 is that we continually campaign and it fails to deliver on its promises. So for this G8 in Italy, we really are, I think, at the end of our patience with it, and we're looking to other meetings like the G20 meeting in London, and there'll be a further one this year in Scotland or at the UN to see if they can deliver, because the legitimacy of the G8 really is on the wane.
So it's a talking shop for the rich and the powerful, but it doesn't come up with the goods.
Well, since 2005, we've seen an increasing failure on those returns. So it really is a kind of last chance saloon for the G8 this year. Well, people really will question what its purpose is, apart from a shindig for rich countries to eat and sort of make merry.
Let the lowly hear and be glad.
Joseph Donnelly is the permanent delegate to the United Nations for Caritas Internationalis. He too shares Patrick's pessimism concerning what is likely to emerge from this G8 summit. Let's hear my interview with him.
Now, I gather that you were at the last G8 summit in Japan last year. How many of the promises that were made by the G8 leaders at that summit have been kept?
Next to none. The premise of what was urgently needed are still the agenda items for this summit, and many of them are not even been fully discussed or extrapolated out of last year's summaries. And we would suggest that since the level of support from an aid point of view and the level of effectiveness for aid support has not moved, in fact, it's probably moved in the negative.
Why such a poor showing?
Under the competing confusion of the fiscal crisis, the recent past fuel crisis, and the global economic crisis, everyone has had a distracting reason to say, yes, but, yes, later, well, maybe then, really, rather than finding face up, eyeball to eyeball, how desperate the circumstances are and how doable a change in the sort of status quo could make a difference. So our argument would be there was a slight hope that in Japan, at G8 in Japan, there was some readiness to sort of shake in and make some moves, especially relative to climate change, some seriousness about poverty and hunger, health. But after the collision of the events of the past 12 months, it's desperately discouraging that people have stepped even further back, and the level of cooperation has fragmented. So where you had some spirit of goodwill, and whether it's the G8, the G20, the G8 plus one, we're in a much more desperate place today than we were before. And additionally, the compounding effects of disasters of natural disasters have so sort of extended the urgency that the international community has not kept up. The diplomatic community has not been able to match ideas, technology, with real implementation on the ground. And so there is a huge fear that we're moving faster, but backwards rather than forward in these matters.
Are there any countries at all that have, in fact, set a slightly less dispiriting example of backtracking? I mean, you know, some countries that may have at least maintained their aid levels?
I think it's fair to say in almost every roundup of these questions that the Scandinavians are usually at the top of the list and pretty much stay there and have made that commitment.
But they're not part of the G8.
No, oh no, exactly. So if you stick with the G8 alone, there isn't much to get excited about from anybody. One of the challenging questions is to say, even where there's been some indicator of more verbal commitment and clarity about support, one has to really go back and ask, is that column A simply being cut in two and shifted to column B and C and then moved once more? So there isn't been any groundswell of urgent new money that will make a difference at this point in time. There is a lot of intellectual investment in the ways things could be done better and should be done better, but if they don't go beyond that, then they're really just more white papers that aren't going to feed the poor or clean the air or make people healthier in better situations. And that's our fear. Our fear is that without a global partnership, we keep fragmenting some strengths that were built up in the past 5 years or so, and that's an urgent crisis for us. Poverty and the desperate situation of need is a moral challenge to any human being, and our way to best accompany that crisis is to do so by staying firm where we are. And while many NGOs around the world would be suffering with difficulty, local and international, with budget cuts, for us, because we're present as a grassroots organization in 201 countries and territories, we walk where the poor eat or starve. So what's our bread is their bread, and we look for ways to find the mechanisms that let us do more, even when it's slightly less.
Just one very, very quick question and answer to sum up, coming back to this ongoing G8 summit. So are you expecting anything at all to come out? Or again, a lot of nice-sounding promises, but, you know, promises that are not likely to be kept?
I think the question is right on the mark. And so the matter for us is much will be said. Some of it could be well-intentioned and credible. But for us, the only value of that engagement will be that the credibility is matched by absolute time-framed implementation, and we're still yet to see that. So we go forward, which is our style, to hope beyond hope that someone is listening. But we remain enormously concerned that 2015 is tomorrow, and we have empty hands.
I was speaking to Joseph Donnelly, permanent delegate to the United Nations for Caritas Internationalis. And earlier, you heard the voice of Patrick Nicholson, Head of Communications at Caritas Internationalis. Well, that's all for today, but we'll be back on the air at the same time tomorrow. And you can always find our programmes on the internet at www.vaticanradio.org. Laudato Jesus Christus.